This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
4 weeks into the Nancy Guthrie investigation and still no suspect, no person of interest, no body, but the evidence tells a story. Was there prior visits to a home, a suspect you didn't know about a doorbell camera until he was standing in front of it, grabbing foliage, improvised attempts to cover the lens? This doesn't look like a professional operation. It looks like someone who thought they knew what they were doing and didn't. If this was a burglary that went sideways and Nancy Guthrie died during a confrontation that a perpetrator never intended to have happen, what does that person face legally right now if they come forward, if they're ever caught? Former felony prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis is with us to break down what this all means. Felony murder, concealment charges, the difference between surrendering and getting caught, and whether there's any path forward for someone sitting with this or whether that window has already closed. Eric, as always, thank you for being here. Arizona has felony murder. If someone breaks into a home and a death occurs during that burglary, even if the death wasn't intended, walk us through what that charge means and why intent to kill doesn't always matter under that statute.
Yeah, that is sort of a creative law that originated decades ago, whereby, you know, if there was a commission of a felony and someone died during the course thereof, the states decided, hey, we want to punish that just like we would punish murder, because there were so many casualties that were happening during these high level felonies. And so, yeah, for example, if someone is in the commission of a felony and they didn't even intend to kill another person, but another person dies as a result of those criminal actions, even though they don't necessarily rise to the level of intent to kill, they can still qualify for felony murder, which still typically has the same severe penalties.
I guess if they catch whoever did this, it will probably be argued, if this was a B&E gone wrong, of I didn't intend to kill her. And let's say there was nothing that really took place where, you know, they took some sort of action. They didn't grab a frying pan and knock her over the head. And I'm just throwing random shit out there. There's no evidence of that. But let's say that you know, she got up out of bed, slipped, like something on her own fruition. She was startled awake, slipped, fell, hit her head, something like that. And they're like, oh, God. And she dies. Now they got a dead body. They didn't physically go in and attack the woman or see to her death. But certainly their presence caused her to be alert enough to wake up, and then all this stuff went down, and then they took a body. Does it matter the actions of the individual in a location like this if they physically were the ones that carried out the physicality that would have caused the injury that resulted in death, or just being in the presence and then whatever happened around that person if they ended up dying, even if accidental, does that still qualify under that?
For most felony murder statutes, it doesn't require an intent to kill. It doesn't require that you physically be the executioner of someone else. You know, really the idea is that if you're engaged in one of these qualifying felonies, which burglary is always a qualifying felony for felony murder, and then something horrible happens. You know, that's kind of why the law came about, is because people were engaged in committing all sorts of high-level felonies, drug stuff, eluding, kidnapping, everything under the sun, burglaries, and then unfortunately someone dies during that. Well, you don't get off the hook for that just because you didn't intend the death. That's really the purpose of the statute. And so sometimes it's easier to prove felony murder than it would be first degree murder, where you have to prove intent to kill and after deliberation.
What about hiding a body? Because obviously there ain't no body here right now. So it's somewhere and it ain't in any sort of location where it should be. That I'm sure has its own other set of charges. What might someone be looking at there in addition to this?
Oh, sure. There are a number of things that come up. It could be abuse of a corpse. It could be obstruction of an investigation. It could be destruction of evidence. There are a number of potential charges that can follow from trying to cover up some horrible act, including like disposing of a body. And so those charges are certainly very serious as well. And there are a number of other ones that this person could face, depending on whether Nancy is alive or dead.
There is a meaningful legal difference between walking into a police station today versus getting caught through DNA 6 months from now. I mean, what exactly does that difference look like in terms of what prosecutors can argue and what a judge sees at sentencing? If someone were to somehow be inspired to step up and go, yeah, I'm probably going to get caught at some point here, is there an incentive? Is there, you know, is there lesser of a penalty if someone were to come up and say, yeah, horrible thing that went terribly wrong, was not intending to kill, but yes, there is felony murder, and but they're coming, they're the ones that are going, yeah, this is what happened, I did it, versus we finally caught you 6 months later and you've put all of us and all of these resources through hell and back. It's going to be looked at a little differently, would it not?
You would sure think so. And common sense would kind of tell us, hey, and you know, the lessons we're given as children, hey, if you do something bad, you should take responsibility. You should fess up for it. And a lot of times we think that could garner some leniency or sympathy from the government. And sometimes it does. But oftentimes those benefits are never realized when a person thinks they're doing, you know, the right thing by coming in and confessing. Usually they're treated almost equally as harshly. Now, sometimes these folks can try to broker some kind of leniency before doing that through an intermediary like a like an attorney. I would hate to be the liaison for something like that. But you know, if the attorney, for example, approached the prosecutor and was like, hey, this person will come forward if you agree to something that's 40 years in prison or less, perhaps there's an agreement that could be made that could lead to such a benefit.
That's an interesting angle. How can that work? I mean, let me walk me through that, the dynamics of that, of a, let's say the person who did this gets in contact with an attorney, says, I will reveal where the body is, I will come forward, but I need to have some sort of deal on the table. Is that a thing? I mean, can that be brokered through an attorney? Would the attorney be in some sort of legal quandary? The fact that they'd be talking or negotiating with someone who is admitting to this sort of crime and they have knowledge of where they are or anything of that nature. How give me the dynamics of that, where the attorney themselves doesn't get into some sort of hot water of betting in this sort of crime in some way, shape or form.
Oh, to be clear, I think there would be a risk on the attorney's behalf, yeah, as well, because, you know, especially if Nancy is still alive, time is of the essence. And if you're, you know, engaging in a back and forth negotiation while that clock is ticking, do you become complicit,
yeah,
in a sense? You know, and to be clear, I haven't seen this. I haven't seen this personally in a case before, but the attorney could try to be that liaison and try to say, hey, we want justice for the family. We want to resolve this for everybody involved, including my client. You know, if he comes forward, will you agree to something that's like 40 years or less? That being said, I think that subjects the attorney to potential investigation, including, like, you know, surveillance. Who is he meeting with? Who is he, mm-hmm, seeing? And even though those meetings and communications with clients are private and confidential, when the attorney is inserting themselves in such a fashion, I think that that could be eyes on the attorney as well. There could be some ethical issues that arise too. Not saying it's a great idea, just saying it's possible.
Yeah, I mean, and at this point it feels like anything could be possible in this case. Yeah, that really opens up some interesting avenues of what could happen. But first you have to have a person that is inspired enough to want to come forward. And obviously this far in, they probably don't. I mean, unless something, you know, something changes here at some point. There's been a lot of issues with this investigation, and it's being argued on every end of, you know, some folks saying this is, you know, a lot of folks saying, I should say that, a lot of folks under Nanos' own administration saying, you know, no faith in him. We don't trust this. This is an ego show, things of that nature. Nanos himself denying all this, saying, no, this is, no, everything's fine. I got it handled. The FBI, some sources in there from some folks saying he should hand it all off to the FBI so they can be the lead. That hasn't happened yet, and we still have no Nancy Guthrie. This has got to be utter hell for the Guthrie family, for Savannah and her brother and her sister, as they try and navigate the waters of this. At the end of the day, when they look back on this investigation, if they can identify missteps, if ego got in the way in some way, shape, or form, are there any levers that can be pulled from the Guthrie family for any sort of recourse or any sort of consequence to action or lack of action or ego-based action? If they wanted to go after any of the authorities in this situation, I'm not saying they will or they would or they should, but when you have a lot of really obvious missteps, and if you can prove that legally, I know officers are very, very well insulated. Is there any civil course for that, or even criminal, if they were to find something that was not done properly?
You know, I think this entire saga has, of course, been terribly traumatic and disappointing for the Guthrie family. And if they went the route of trying to go after law enforcement for some kind of missteps or negligence, I think it might be equally unsatisfying. Like you mentioned, most law enforcement enjoys some degree of immunity for their official acts. And that includes those acts that suck. It includes when they make mistakes and they make errors, there's no like legal claim you can bring viably to say, hey, this law enforcement should have done better and they didn't. And now something as horrible has happened to my family. You know, you'd have to prove the final outcome of what happened. There's some evidentiary issues as well. But the long and short of it is that there are not many viable options to try to remedy any sort of misstep on behalf of law enforcement, at least for the Guthrie family.
What would you be advising the Guthrie family right now? I mean, it's not like we have a suspect or we're going to court or we're prosecuting a case or anything of that nature, but they are very much wrapped up right now in the emotion of this, and rightfully so. It's not exactly, they're not in an opportune place to be seeing two or three steps down the road of where this could all go and preparing themselves for that. And sometimes you look back two or three steps down the road and go, darn, I wish I would have done that back then. That would have made this easier. I mean, from a legal standpoint, again, not knowing, you know, where this choose your own adventure book goes, what would you be saying them to them right now as they're trying to obviously get their mother, at least her body back? Is there anything legal that they should be thinking about right now? Anything they should be preparing for down the road of the potential roads or the potential paths where this goes?
You know, what a terrible purgatory that this family must be in, because, you know, there are glimmers of hope here and there, and they want to believe that their family member is still alive. They don't have any compelling evidence of that. The days drag on and they're fearing, God, what is my mother going through? What are they putting her through? So in terms of legal steps, though, I think it was smart for them to offer the $1 million, which I heard they recently offered for information, up to $1 million. I think sort of taking the reins as best they can when, you know, the law enforcement side is not bringing about the outcomes that they need. They've got to look to other options, certainly hiring a private investigator. I presume they've already done that. But that can sometimes give rise to more leads. Petitioning the government, making social media statements about it, trying to get Trump involved. I know Trump said that he would allocate federal resources towards this. I think those types of non-traditional pushes, while not necessarily legal measures, are measures that can bring about a better outcome potentially, or at least increase that likelihood.
What about to someone who's listening that has intimate knowledge? I'm not talking, hey, I think my neighbor's acting strange. I'm talking, yeah, I know my cousin did this, or they know, like, it's just however reason they know it was told to them. There's just, the knowledge is there, and it's black and white. There's no question about it. They know, they're not saying anything. They don't want to blow up their family. They don't want to get in trouble themselves. They don't want to face repercussions. They don't want to be a snitch. But they also feel, you know, somewhat morally obligated of like, this is a horrible thing and this person should be held accountable. But they're looking out for their own best interests, and there's $1 million on the line that could be yours if the price is right. How How would you advise someone if they came to you and said, I know about this, I have intimate information, my own safety could be in jeopardy here if I, you know, say this publicly. I'd like to reveal this, but I need to be safe myself. And how do I get the money? Because I'm going to reveal information to you that's going to put my own safety in line, and I'm going to need that to get away. You know, it's not just like, hey, let's show up at the police station and hope that everybody just does their best. Here's the check. Go run away. What would you be telling someone if they came to you and had that sort of information?
Well, I think they should certainly engage an attorney who can try to protect their best legal interests while navigating this sort of treacherous, horrible pathway of providing potential information that could lead to this 84-year-old woman's discovery and hopefully she's still alive. But I think coming forward sooner rather than later is preferable. I think the more this person waits, the more eyebrows are raised, the more condemnation they could face. I think doing it through an attorney in a private fashion can help protect their anonymity, but they got to make the payment to somebody or to some account. And there's got to be people associated with that account, most likely. And so I don't know you're going to be able to be completely anonymous. And in fact, usually providing this information contains the condition that you will continue to cooperate. And so everybody around the world is going to know your name, but they're going to know that you had this information. They're going to wonder how long have you had it before you shared it. So I think coming forward sooner rather than later is key. Brokering some protections for yourself through an attorney, like saying, hey, if I give you this, you're going to give me immunity. You're not going to prosecute me. Those kinds of things are really important.
Can the government, I mean, I don't know if you know the answer to this. I know I don't. Can the government offer some sort of protections out here for somebody like that other than just cash? Because that's going to be the bigger pull. That's going to be the draw. It's not just money that's going to make somebody talk. It's going to be knowing that they're safe. Their security is going to be number one on that list. And nothing speaks to that right now in terms of inspiring them to come forward. Is that something that maybe authorities should be putting up under the table of, look, if you got that type of information, we will protect you. We can. I've never seen that done. Not saying it hasn't been done. It's just to my knowledge. I don't know. What's your thought? Is that a lever that can even be pulled here?
You know, it seems pretty consistent with general witness protection, and most law enforcement agencies have that option, especially the FBI. Mm-hmm. And so the government could sweeten the deal in that sense and say, hey, if you come forward and this information promptly leads to an arrest, then we will give you immunity and we'll provide some kind of modicum of witness protection. Now, usually witness protection happens after the legal proceedings are done. So it's not like they could keep this person anonymous the entire time. Mm-hmm. Even in confidential informant cases, usually the government has to disclose that informant if the case is going to trial. Yeah. So there are some protections, but they are not absolute. And this person still could be subject to, some kind of negative outcome for engaging in this.
And then you're relying on the government not to F it up. Which is the big roll of the dice. And if we're looking so far at what they're just trying to do with what's in their own control, that's not a big, bill of faith where you're like, oh, these they seem to really know what they're doing. They're not possibly going to screw up my involvement or me coming forward and put me in any sort of danger. That's why all these things matter. You have to inspire the person to come forward, and it's like everything is working against that. But it is a roll of the dice, and there are possible paths forward. Hopefully someone can do that. Your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube and on our Substack. The links are in the description. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts on where this is all going. Let's move over to another case. A couple days in now to the Corey Richens murder trial. More than a couple, really. Into the end of the first week, the defense is hammering one central point. After 4 years and 10 searches of the Richens home, prosecutors still can't show the jury how fentanyl got into Eric Richens' body. Defense attorney Kathy Nestor opened by declaring there's zero evidence connecting her client to the act itself, only circumstantial evidence of motive and opportunity, with testimony this week revealing untested Moscow Mule cups, white specks on the nightstand that were never analyzed, and first responders who didn't secure the kitchen where the drinks were allegedly made. The defense is building a foundation of investigative failure. Eric Faddis, former prosecutor turned defense attorney, is here to walk us through why these gaps matter and whether the prosecution's motive evidence can survive them. Eric, the defense made that striking claim in opening statements after 4 years of investigation, and as recently as 2 weeks ago, I don't know what they were doing 2 weeks ago in a case that's this old, searching the home. Prosecutors still cannot show how fentanyl got into Eric Richin's body. They have a story, but they don't have the physical evidence. From a defense standpoint, this is where we're going to tackle this segment from, is from a defense standpoint. Our next segment, we're going to talk about the prosecution. How significant is it when a prosecution has to rely entirely on circumstantial evidence for the actual mechanism of death, especially in a poisoning case where the method should leave traces?
It is a problem. And this is something I've seen time and again on both sides of the courtroom. You might have a really good case on paper and you tell it to somebody and they're like, hey, that seems super suspicious. That's got, this is lining up. This person's got to be guilty. But when you really get down to that gauntlet of trial, every little piece is scrutinized. And if some of these critical pieces don't hold up to that scrutiny, well, you've got some doubt there. And it reminds me of a homicide case I had not too long ago where someone was saying that my client had injured this baby but they couldn't say the mechanism of injury, like when it happened, how it happened. There was no, in that case, there was no motive for him to hurt his child or anything like that. And so the government thought they had a great case going in. But when we got into trial, they couldn't show that mechanism of injury, that mechanism of death. And that's proved extremely problematic for them. We won with a complete not guilty verdict, and my client didn't do that. But at any rate, those without showing that mechanism of death, without really getting down to the nitty gritty and spelling it out for the jury, prosecutors got problems.
One of the big things that they're pointing at here is basically sloppy police work. One of the big things that they're looking at, the Moscow Mule mugs, those copper mugs, they could have shown so much had they been tested. The very cups the prosecution theory depends on. They were never tested for fentanyl because, they say the nanny put them in the dishwasher the next morning. Deputy Nguyen admitted he didn't secure the kitchen. At what point in an investigation like this, because they came into this scene as first responders to someone dying. They didn't know what was going on. It was try and rescue this person, bring them back if they can. They're not looking at it necessarily as a homicide in those exact first moments. But it seems that they failed to ever flip the switch over to go, what if? What if? How does that take place in an investigation in a scene like this, where, of course, at the beginning, it looks like it's an accident or something horrible that happened naturally, whatever it may be? When is it up to the investigators, the police, the first responders, the people that are showing up to say, maybe we better treat this like not just some sort of horrible accident or natural death? Maybe we need to start looking at this as a possible homicide. I mean, that's a hard thing to do when you got the wife right there crying, please, he's going to be okay, right? It's an emotional shift to start looking at it from another direction, but you kind of need to if you really want to thoroughly have all your ducks in a row should this ever, get to a trial like this is.
Tony, from the outset, you have to operate as law enforcement as all options are potentially on the table until they are conclusively excluded. So I've been on death call as a prosecutor, and I've got calls in the middle of the night, had to go out to, some grisly parts of Aurora, Colorado, and there's a dead body. And sometimes it really appears from the outset that this must be a suicide, that this person there were indications that it was done by themselves. But still, you still secure the scene. You still investigate and seize evidence for testing, even when you think that, hey, it's probably a suicide. But what if you're wrong? What if things change? What if we get more information, more evidence as the investigation goes on? This is the first day. And so you've got to have that option on the table from the beginning and be operating as if, hey, we need to do everything we can to rule out homicide, to rule out accident, to rule out suicide, and come to really the truth of the matter here. And it looks like, law enforcement may have jumped to conclusions in the beginning, and that's kind of biting them in the butt right now.
How often does that happen in cases like this where it's just, I mean, because there were so many things here. You got the pill bottle right next to him. Yeah, I mean, I can kind of forgive the mugs. I mean, that may not be something you're going to think of immediately, but the pill bottle was right there too. Also not tested. They could have taken that pill bottle. They could have swabbed it. They could have looked for trace amounts of fentanyl or something in there and determined what the hell was in that bottle that was expired. But there was nothing in the bottle. None of that was done. There's some very obvious things that were just simply not looked at. How frequently does this sort of thing occur where it's just like, we don't look at it like that from that perspective, even though we should. And what kind of an effect do you think this is going to have on a jury in this case, where some of these key elements that they say are key pieces to the case, but we can't really prove there's anything to do with his death with any of these things?
You know, I think a lot of eyebrows are raised by a number of the pieces of evidence in the case, the Google searches, the book, all sorts of things. But raising of eyebrows is not the same as proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the highest standard of the criminal justice system. And juries, especially with kind of this modern CSI effect, they want to see forensics. They want to see testing. They want to see assessments done. They want to see science to back up whatever the government is saying happened. And it certainly does happen where you go to a scene and, hey, this looks pretty cut and dried like a suicide. But people can frame suicides. People can put things within a room that make it appear as if it's one thing when it's really another. And so the discerning officer and the prosecutor, usually there's a prosecutor who's out there that there wasn't when I did it. That prosecutor's got to be on top of that too and sort of second guess and say, hey, did we think about this? Hey, just in case, shouldn't we seize that piece of evidence? And those things, I think, are best practices.
Why do you think they did in here?
I get the impression, based on the county, I believe this is Summit County, Colorado, where I practice in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And so that's a more rural jurisdiction. That is something
it's
that
Utah, actually.
A homicide. Go ahead. Yeah. They see accidental deaths. They see natural deaths. They see things like that probably more often. And so perhaps that was the frame, the lens through which they were viewing this scene when they arrived. And they said, yeah, kind of adds up. Looks like it was suicide or an accident or something else. And I think that, I'm not accusing them of laziness or something like that. But I think that you've got to be overly diligent anytime you have a death case. And it sounds like they could have been more diligent with respect to some of those items.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. I mean, it's almost kind of sounds like getting too comfortable in a really bad, bad situation that our country is in with the fentanyl deaths, where you just get so used to it of people overdosing and it not being necessarily nefarious, where someone was intending to kill, but someone ends up killing themselves because they think they're taking one thing and it's not what they were planning. Crime scene technician Chelsea Gibson testified she found no drugs or drug paraphernalia in the house on her initial visit back on March 4th of 2022. Yet years later, searches, including one apparently just 2 weeks ago before the trial, continued to turn up evidence. THC gummies, prescription bottles, defense is hammering the chain of custody and the fact that investigators kept going back. What does it tell you when a crime scene is searched 10 times over 4 years and evidence keeps appearing?
Can't say I've ever seen that happen, except for this case. I've seen cases in which a property has been searched two or three times over the course of several years, but the frequency with which this location was repeatedly searched tells me that he didn't do it right the first time, and he didn't do it right the second time, and he didn't do it right the third time. And I think that's the argument defense is going to make to the jury, is how incompetent is this law enforcement? And if we can't place faith in the investigation, can we really place faith in the legal conclusions that are based on that investigation? I think that's a problem for the prosecution.
I mean, the reality is two things can be simultaneously happening at the same time, a really shitty investigation and a murder. And unfortunately, sometimes if the investigation is shitty enough, the person can get away with murder. The death certificate remains saying undetermined. This was brought up in opening statements. To this day, not homicide, because apparently the person who was signing that retired before the investigation concluded and lacked enough information to rule definitively before then. How damaging is it to a murder prosecution when their own medical examiner won't call it a homicide on the death certificate?
Oh, I would hammer on that so hard in trial as defense attorney.
Yeah.
I would just say, hey, look, the central incident here in this case is a death. And the foremost expert for the government is not even comfortable telling you that it was a homicide, let alone that it was Corey Richens, and let alone the circumstances under which it was conducted. They haven't even got that first predicate part yet, that this was, in fact, a murder. You know, that means they couldn't rule out accident. They couldn't rule out suicide. And undetermined sounds a lot like uncertain, and uncertain sounds a lot like doubt. And that sounds a lot like reasonable doubt.
Yeah, and that's what you need. That's all you need. They don't have to line it all out. They just need to prove reasonable doubt, and there's a lot of it in this case. There's a lot of evidence that shows Corey not being a great human being, a cheater, someone who was lying about money, it looks like, very irresponsible with it. A lot of bad acts, but all those bad acts do not always necessarily make a murderer, though, either. And we're talking about putting someone away for the rest of their life. That all matters. It's going to be a really interesting conversation, I'm sure, that's going to be going on back in that jury room when they have to make their decision here. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, as we talk about the defense there of Corey Richens, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and our YouTube. Be sure to leave them. We'll love to continue our conversation there. Let's talk about the prosecution in the case of Corey Richens. Prosecutor Brad Bloodworth opened by telling jurors that Corey Richens murdered her husband for his money and a fresh start at life. The prosecution's case is built on layers. $4.5 million in debt, fraudulently obtained life insurance policy, a Caribbean vacation booked months in advance with her boyfriend, and text messages expressing love to that boyfriend the same night Eric died. They've shown the jury body camera footage of the morning Eric was found, presented testimony from his devastated family, and laid out a timeline suggesting premeditation, going back to an alleged Valentine's Day poisoning attempt. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, drawing on his own prosecutorial background, is with us to help analyze whether this mountain of circumstantial evidence can carry a conviction and where the case might be vulnerable. Eric, welcome. Prosecutor Brad Bloodworth told jurors that Eric Richens had several times a lethal amount of fentanyl in his system, 15 nanograms per millimeter. And that, this level, proves intent, not an accident. The medical examiner confirmed that this was a toxic dose. How does the prosecution use dosage to quantify and to argue premeditation? And is five times a lethal dose genuinely as dispositive as they're arguing here? We are talking fentanyl, and just the tip of a needle is enough to kill, basically. So we're talking five tips of needles. Again, not a whole lot. It's very easy to overdose and die from this. What's your thoughts on that argument that they're bringing to the jury?
It is, and I think they're smart to sort of leverage that dosage. Every case is good facts and bad facts, and that's a good fact for the prosecution. Because, you know, especially if defense gets up there and says this was an accidental overdose, usually accidental overdoses are, you know, one time the lethal amount, two times the lethal amount. Someone usually doesn't just take, you know, a monster amount of substance, unless it's a non-accidental overdose and they were trying to commit suicide, which is another possibility. But I think the prosecution is going to argue that, hey, this dosage was something that was calculated. There was the intended outcome here. It wasn't, recreational. It wasn't accidental. Whoever administered this dosage intended for Eric Richens to die, and we're saying that's Corey Richens.
You know, there's all sorts of evidence, obviously, that comes to play in a courtroom. You have the physical evidence, you have circumstantial evidence. Some of that circumstantial evidence these days is digital evidence, digital footprints that come to light. And surprise, I don't know if it's just surprisingly or not, it seems to have a weight to it that sometimes is heavier than DNA, that sometimes is heavier than an eyewitness, sometimes heavier than even physical evidence, because it dives into the psyche of the person in question, the person being accused. And there's a lot of that in this case. You have the internet search history showing Corey searching, what is a lethal dose of fentanyl? Could be an innocent question. Could be they say he died of this. I'm curious what that is. How long do life insurance companies take to pay? Again, could be, my husband just died. He was our source of income. I wonder how long that takes. There's other searches, though. Can cops uncover deleted messages, iPhone? And there's others, too, that aren't so explainable, if you will. How do you build a narrative around digital forensics like this without feeling like you're cherry picking from someone's search history and the jury's going, you're just doing this to make it look like that? How do you really help the jury fully see the context of this person's, for lack of a better term, depravity in their search history?
Yeah, you know, I think one compelling component of digital forensics is that it can show depravity. It can show these like character traits. We're talking about DNA, we're talking about fingerprints. That's sort of a sterilized type thing. You know, you don't really get a glimpse into the psyche of the person, but like you said, with digital forensics, you're learning what's going on inside this person's head. And one thing you do is you match those searches up with other external evidence, witness statements, including like, I can't remember who it was, Eric or somebody else who said, you know, if I die, it was my wife or something. Yep. Along those lines. When you combine those searches with this other external evidence that appears corroborative, then it looks less like cherry picking and more like a totality of the story that the prosecution is conveying to this jury about what happened.
I found it interesting that the defense of Corey Richens, she, in her opening statements and in some of her arguments that she's made so far, the attorney has been, they were going to work it out. They had their hiccups. They've had their problems, but they're still together and they're wanting to make this work. Okay. But why is Corey booking an all-inclusive Caribbean resort vacation for herself and her boyfriend for a month after Eric dies? This was actually booked before Eric died, and it was planned. I mean, it's not exactly going to the timeline or the storyline of, oh, we're going to work this out. You're not going on a Caribbean all-inclusive vacation with your boyfriend if you're working on your marriage. It's one thing to say, okay, we're not going to judge their marriage. Maybe they're in an open relationship, whatever. That's their deal. That's their business. But they're not saying that. They're saying, oh, no, they're tight. They're loving. They're figuring this out. And there's so much evidence to the contrary. It seems like a weird road to go down, a weird argument to make, because it's so easily disproven. Is that a mistake on the part of the defense of Corey Richens to try and paint them as this couple that's working their shit out when everything points to the exact opposite of that, like actual evidence?
You've got to be so careful as a defense attorney to try and maintain your credibility with the jury, because sometimes from the very beginning, they're looking at you with a side eye. They're like, oh my God, your client's accused of homicide and you're representing him. And then when you get up there, if you're overplaying your hand, if you are trying to sell them something that is not substantiated by evidence, might be contradicted by evidence, you can ruin that credibility. And that causes the jury to look skeptically at all the other evidence and cross-examination and everything else the defense intends to present. And so you've got to be so careful about that. And this one seems like a bit of an oversell to me, especially when there's the trip booked and everything else. I think the jury might look at that and say, you know, she's lying to us about what Corey wanted to do with this relationship. What else is she lying to us about?
Another thing that the prosecution is trying to connect is the Valentine sandwich. I'd still like to know what the sandwich was. I really would. Like, what type of, was it an Italian? Was it like ham and cheese? Whatever. That's, that seems to be missing in this story.
Yes, I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, what did Eric like? What are you mixing the fentanyl with? Because there's the sandwich, and then there's Corey procuring drugs. Supposedly oxy. There's something was in that sandwich. We don't know what, because then he says he got violently ill, maybe took an EpiPen, maybe did not, laid down, but he survived. And he told his friends and his family, I think my wife is trying to poison me. There had also been allegations from way back. I don't think this is getting into the trial, but from way back on, a trip to Greece where he had suspected possibly that that was happening. But again, we don't have the sandwich. We can't test it. We don't know. It's basically he got sick after eating a sandwich that was given to him from his wife. It could have been tainted ham, quite honestly. That's the thing. It happens. If you've ever had tainted ham, it's not a good time. That could possibly be an excuse. The only thing that really ties the sandwich to any sort of misdeeds, obviously the fact that he got sick, is the fact that then she's asking for something stronger from the housekeeper. The Michael Jackson stuff specifically. This is propofol, which is not what she got. I don't think she knew what she was talking about. But that's the connection there. How difficult is it going to be for the jury to believe that sandwich that she gave him on Valentine's Day was laced with something, when again, there ain't no sandwich to test, and there was no Eric that got tested either for any sort of ingestion of a poisonous substance.
Tony, I was just talking about how defense can overplay their hand. Prosecution can overplay their hand too, and sometimes even in a more damning way. If they can't back up this accusation of attempted murder by sandwich, if they don't have any substantial compelling evidence supporting that, and I'm defense up there, I'm saying, hey, look, they are trying to just throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks. This guy got sick after eating a sandwich, and all of a sudden my client's accused of trying to poison him to death. And then they're trying to buttress this other allegation of poisoning for which there is not significant evidence. Just trying to make it seem like this person's a terrible poisoner who's doing this to her husband. I think there's a chance the government overplays their hand with that accusation. I've said that from the beginning, and I think it was questionable to even bring it as part of this trial. Could backfire hugely.
You saw the body cam footage of that moment where they got there, and Corey's in her matching pajamas and her hair's up. And Eric's sister says it was weird because it looked like Corey was kind of made up, like she was prepared for company, if you will, at that moment in time. That was her take. That was her perception on it. Without going into my opinion or anybody else's opinion, what was your take on watching her actions, her reactions in that body cam video as her husband was trying to be revived by first responders?
You know, it doesn't necessarily align with how we might expect to see someone in that scenario who was innocent reacting. Certainly there's the specter of, was she orchestrating this all along? She knew the police would be there. She coordinated her appearance in a way that she wanted to present. And, she saw this coming. Or is it just that, gosh, this was just her normal actions and she didn't really know what to do or how to react when her husband is dead? And so, I'm not sure it moves the needle too far one way or the other. I think the prosecution's going to make a bigger deal out of it than it might be. And again, that could be the prosecution overplaying their hand and then them losing credibility with the jury potentially.
And the prosecution, the big thing in their hand that they seem to be trying to play is that this whole thing was financially motivated. The day Eric died, Corey owed about $4.5 million to more than 20 different lenders, was about to close on a $3.2 million mansion she couldn't afford. And Eric had over 200 overdraft transactions totaling $300,000 in the months before his death. So not exactly fiscally responsible. Eric apparently not happy about any of these things either in the time leading up to his death. His estate personally worth more than $4 million. It's quite a bridge to cross to try and convince a jury that someone took the life of the father of their three children for money, for some sort of financial security or situation. Because if you look at this, you could go, well, they could figure it out. There may be some tough times, but there's enough flowing this way and that way that they could figure this out. It doesn't necessarily seem like, do you need to murder someone over this? There wasn't like dire situations of, you know, one's going to go be destitute next week. As a former prosecutor, how do you present financial desperation without the jury thinking lots of people have debt and don't kill their spouses?
Yeah, good question. Because I think that there was similar challenges to the motive in the Alec Murdoch case, where they were saying, oh, he killed his wife and kid because he had this financial distress going on. It's kind of a logical disconnect there. But if I'm the prosecutor, I'm saying, hey, this is real stress in a person's life. Money matters. And you know, we're not talking 100,000. We're talking 4+ million. We're talking 20+ lenders. When you see the walls closing in, sometimes you get desperate. And lo and behold, there's this life insurance policy that'll at least get me $1 million+, maybe more. That'll be a big chunk. That'll take care of a big chunk of my woes. On top of that, I'm not in a good relationship with my husband anyway. I don't like him. You know, is it so far of a measure to take to try to improve one's situation? If I'm the prosecutor, that's the argument I'm making. But there's certainly counter arguments.
At the end of the day, in this case, is she going to go down because of memes? You know what I'm talking about? Where the memes were revealed at the very end of the opening statements by the prosecution. Memes showing someone wiping their nose with $100 bills. Meme saying, I'm rich, I'm rich. And another one, basically, this would be if you were to assume that she look these things up. Idiots everywhere, alluding to all the people, the first responders, the people who are in her home trying to help her, trying to console her, trying to figure out what happened to her husband. She is sitting there on her phone looking, idiots everywhere. My God, she like hit like three emotional pain points with those three different memes. Is that what a jury's going to look at the end of the day? All the other evidence be damned and go, bitch is going down. Because who the hell looks at those sort of things in that sort of situation? I don't know how you're going to explain that one away.
Certainly peculiar. And, you know, as we've seen social media take sort of front and center stage in some of these criminal trials with videos and posts and things like that, now we're even getting more granulated down to just memes, different memes people are looking at. What does it say about them? What does it say about what's going on in their mental state? What does it say about their intentions, how they're viewing something that has just happened? Certainly a jury could look at those and draw inferences, you know, about what was going on in Corey's head, and is that consistent with how an innocent person would act under those circumstances? So, you know, this might not be the first time we've seen memes in trials, and I think it's definitely not going to be the last, which is sort of a bizarre prospect to even think about.
We're at memes. I guess emojis are the next thing that we're going to see in a case. What did the emojis mean? What did you mean by the ham sandwich emoji and the skull and bones? That, who knows? I'm sure it will happen within the next 365 days. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight into this and the many cases we got going on here. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and also on YouTube. Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi is what you search on YouTube. The link for Substack is in the description. And of course, be sure to press subscribe wherever you're watching or listening to this so you don't miss any of our coverage. We'll continue our conversation there in the comment section. Until next time, for Todd and Eric, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.